This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. In the national conversation about race, born out of the uprising against deadly police violence targeted at Black Americans, one particular book is getting renewed attention and some criticism. So let's talk about White Fragility, the new book by Robin DiAngelo. She's described as an anti-racist educator, and the book explores the defensiveness that she sees white people turning to when questioned about race and racism. The publisher describes the concept of white fragility as, quote, characterized by emotions such as anger, fear, and guilt, and by behaviors including argumentation and silence. The publisher description goes on to say these behaviors, in turn, function to reinstate white racial equilibrium and prevent any meaningful cross-racial dialogue. Well, earlier this summer, Cincinnati-based St. Peter's United Church of Christ hosted a virtual panel titled Race, Rage, and Fear. It was inspired by DiAngelo's book. Reverend Derek Terry hosted three white panelists to focus on the challenges of discussing race from a white perspective. So we're going to talk about that panel discussion and elaborate on that now with Reverend Derek Terry, who's with us. Reverend, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm well. So glad you could be back with us. And I'm also glad that two of the people who participated in that panel discussion are with us as well. We've got Miami University Assistant Professor Phil Smith. Dr. Smith, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we also have Director of Learning and Culture for Leadership for Educational Equity, Kate McCracken. Kate, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Michael. Thrilled to be here.
And for those of you listening, if you'd like to participate in our conversation, we invite you to do so. Our phone lines are busy with the guest right now, but you can call and talk to our producer, Selena Reeder, and she'll send over your question or comment to us. So call 513-419-7100. You can also email us at talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and get some of those into the show. Reverend Terry, I do want to start with you since it was your church that hosted this panel discussion, and I thought you made some interesting points at the beginning of the discussion, which is still available on YouTube. I watched it, and you talked about how your church, which is diverse, was split on the outcome of the 2016 election. You have a lot of people who were dejected by the election of President Trump and others who were more elated, and you decided that you found yourself in the position of being able to facilitate some conversation about the impact on race in this country as it relates to that election and politics. So give us a little bit of an overview about how you've gone about doing that and your role as pastor at this church and what the response has been among the congregation.
Absolutely. So, yeah, the election took place November 2016, and literally half my church were devastated, and half the church weren't necessarily so much elated as they were, you know, the person they voted for won. And I didn't understand how I could preach or what I could say that Sunday, and it really led me on this path of how do we have these conversations? And if we can't have them in church, where can we have them? I just felt that we were a safe place to have those brave conversations. So 2016 in the fall, we started having discussions on race and racism and anti-racism, and it just kind of blossomed from there. So we've been doing it consistently, several programs a year since then, having really tough, really straightforward, difficult conversations that a lot of people aren't having around race.
And one of those was this virtual panel discussion that we're expanding upon on today's show. And the interesting piece of this is that it's basically white people talking about whiteness and racism in this country. And with what's happening in the country right now, the response to deadly police violence against Black people, we're seeing these protests erupt all over the country, including here in Cincinnati. We are seeing a lot of white people participate in this, and you are seeing more white people speak out about racism and publicly come to terms with their own feelings or perhaps their own prejudices. So you're the Black person we have on this show with us today. And I just want to ask, why is it important that white people take this on among each other?
Because for too long, we've treated racism like a Black problem. It's a Black problem that affects Black people. It's something Black people have to fight against and solve. But racism is an American problem. For 400 years, this country has decided to have a caste system based on race, where people are treated differently based on the color of their skin, no matter where they immigrated from, no matter their descendants. If you could matriculate into whiteness, you're treated differently. And so since it's an American problem, it stains and it hurts all of America. Back in the 50s, when they would shut down swimming pools rather than integrate them, white people couldn't swim either. And so it's going to take all of us to fix this. It's going to take all of us to fix the system of oppression and marginalization that disproportionately hurt black and brown people in our country.
And Reverend, as white people come to grips with this in ways that maybe they haven't before, and if they answer questions or make a statement about their own journey here, you said something during the virtual panel that I thought was interesting and important. You said that we can't get upset when someone gets it wrong when we want them to get it right. And I was hoping you could expand a little bit on that, because it seems like it's possible or even likely that as people start to reflect on this in a new way, in a deeper, more meaningful way, that they could be a little bit clumsy in doing so.
Right.
So how important is patience in this?
Absolutely. So that's the whole point of our Race, Rage, and Fear. And the virtual realm helps people to actually kind of sneak in the back door, sit. They don't have to turn their camera on if they don't want to, and listen. Because you'll get it wrong. I'm working with people, white people, who've been doing this work for 40 or 50 years, and sometimes they get it wrong. But the thing about getting it wrong is there has to be someone there to help you get it right. And so many of my black friends in this current movement are saying, it's not my responsibility to teach white people. And I understand that's not everyone's calling, but half my congregation is white. My godchildren are white. And I felt like someone has to pick up that mantle and teach. And so it's extremely important for people to find those avenues where they can learn, where they can get it wrong. And it does take patience. And just because we say it's a safe place to get it wrong doesn't mean we don't correct people and give them new language and new ideas. But we have to be patient. I've lived this life. So when one of my church members complained that we were talking about race too much, I let her know, I'm a big black guy. That's a privilege that you have. You can turn it on and turn it off. I have to live in this body, in this space, every day. And, you know, that was something she hadn't considered. And, you know, and that's my job as a minister, is to push and to elevate truth.
You know, that's sort of a common reaction, and that's explored a little bit in the presentations that we saw in the virtual panel, and certainly in the book, White Fragility, is that people who may say that they don't see race certainly see it when it's brought up, and it makes them uncomfortable. And let's talk a little bit about why that is. We've been talking with Reverend Derek Terry of St. Peter's United Church of Christ here in Cincinnati, and we're also joined by Miami University Assistant Professor Phil Smith and the Director of Learning and Culture for Leadership for Educational Equity, Kate McCracken. Kate, you were one of the presenters in this virtual panel hosted by St. Peter's United Church of Christ, and you talked in part about racial triggers and even acknowledged yourself in having to deal with these. I think it was, if my memory is correct, it was an email conversation between you and Reverend Terry. So help us understand what racial triggers are. And if you'd like, go ahead and share that story again.
Sure, absolutely. When that happened, I knew that I had to lead my presentation on the panel with describing what happened, because I think myself, like lots of white people who have been doing this work for a little while, start to get attached to the idea of being the good white person in this dynamic, doing the work, and that somehow we may be immune to making mistakes or still having triggers. But ultimately, in D'Angelo's book, she talks about racial triggers being the things that we've been socialized to believe as white people, with whiteness as our dominant culture here in the U.S. And those are things like, there's such a thing as objectivity, or you're an individual, completely independent of others in your community, or that race is a taboo topic. And as a result of learning these things, we experience racial stress, or our triggers are stressed or pushed upon when our viewpoint is named as a racial viewpoint versus the objectivity that we believe in, or our behavior had a racist impact, even if we didn't intend for it to. And I had a funny moment that I shared in the panel where Derek and I were emailing back and forth about the topic I was going to cover, racial triggers. And in my email app, there was a preview of what he had written. He was repeating again, "You have racial triggers," as in that is the topic I'm going to talk about. And no joke, my immediate reaction was, "No, you have racial triggers." There was this little bit of defensiveness that popped up and made me laugh, luckily, but it was surprising.
Well, let's talk about some of these racial triggers. And from your presentation, as seen in that virtual panel hosted by the church, you talk about how we white people are taught to believe that race is a taboo topic, whereas Black Americans in this country don't really have that luxury, because even as Derek referenced in that same panel discussion that we saw online, that if you're Black, you're always, quote, gauging your Blackness in an organization or an event where it's not only Black people. So talk a little bit about why we're taught that race is a taboo topic.
I think it's to avoid discomfort. Derek spoke to this a little bit, but people of color, Black, Indigenous people of color in the United States are uncomfortable every day because of the ways that their racial and ethnic identity have been oppressed or marginalized, whether in big systemic ways or in relational ways, getting jobs, all sorts of things. You know, being more likely to be harmed by a police officer. And white folks have to choose to be uncomfortable. And putting race to the side, like religions or politics or any conversation that is likely to have some intensity to it or bring some tension into our conversations, is something that we've had the ability to just deny. I grew up in the 80s, and the idea of not seeing color was the in vogue view of race among white folks at the time, because it was supposed to be a more evolved one, right? That we're a melting pot and everyone's the same. And it was also a very easy way to be, because it was comfortable to not address the difficulties that come along with acknowledging race and acknowledging all the problems that exist in the racial caste system that Derek described earlier.
And Phil Smith is an assistant professor at Miami University, and your presentation was titled White Fragility in Action. And you note some of the assumptions that perhaps make white people comfortable in topics centered around race. One of them is, I have friends of color, I can't be racist, also known as I have Black friends, and that nothing I can say or do is racist. And one particularly interesting note that you make, Phil, is a list of other perhaps minority designations, LGBTQ, some type of other nationality. And based on that, you can understand the Black experience. Can you explore that a little bit with us?
Sure. From my own experience, I have an example of this in real time at one of the previous institutions where I was a professor. We were going through, a racial crisis that had been an undercurrent and that really came to the surface. And our dean at the time was an Italian immigrant. And one of the things we did is we had this big assembly where all the faculty, staff, students, everybody in the school, this particular medical school, was invited to this assembly, and the dean made this comment of, I think I'm being vilified in a sense. I am an Italian immigrant. I know what it's like. I understand what you're going through. And it's fits in the framework of white fragility, because white fragility is something we experience when we feel that our belief in our goodness as a person is threatened, or our status that we believe we deserve is threatened. And so the idea, you know, when this particular individual was presented with the idea that he might be complicit in contributing to a racist environment, was it experienced as a personal threat. I'm a good person. I've experienced this stuff. How could you say that I'm contributing to it? And what that does is it completely shuts down the conversation. If this person believes that they're immune, right, to contributing to a racist environment, then they're not going to be reflecting on how they're contributing. They're not going to be changing how they're contributing. And this is a person and clearly in a position of power and influence over policy and the overall culture of the institution. And it's just one example, but that's the sort of theme.
One other theme that you explored in your presentation, Phil, were some potential comments that white people might make about black people expressing the need for change, whether it's through protest or possibly the election of a president named Barack Obama. You specifically raised questions, you know, about the birth certificate, that we all recall that long controversy about Barack Obama's origins. We see now a lot of people maybe lukewarm in their support for the protests, but suggesting that the protests are misguided. They're going about protesting wrong. Why is it important to think about those issues?
Again, it has the same result, where if you are focusing on and thinking about, okay, they're not going about this in the right way, people aren't going about this in the right way, obviously from a perspective who's not someone who's not involved in the protests, it again shuts down the conversation. It shuts down any reflection again of what you might be contributing, what you might not be doing that could help things along by focusing on they're not doing it the correct way. And another very specific example of this from my own experience, I had this exact same institution, same situation, different dean, had a conversation in a hallway where our black students had presented a list of demands to the school about things that they could do that would be anti-racist. And instead of having a conversation and engaging a conversation about what was in that list, how can we make some of these things happen and create a more anti-racist environment, the dean's response was they shouldn't have done that. That wasn't the right way to go about it. And again, that means that person's putting on a blocker that's going to blind them off to the possible solutions that bring us all, as Reverend Derek Cherry mentioned, to a better place, that bring us all to a better place.
We're talking with Miami University Assistant Professor Phil Smith and also the Director of Learning and Culture for Leadership for Educational Equity, Kate McCracken. They were brought together for a virtual panel discussion about white fragility, and that was hosted by the Cincinnati-based church, St. Peter's United Church of Christ. Reverend Derek Terry is the pastor there, and he's on the line with us as well. Reverend Terry, what do you think of the book, White Fragility?
I think it is a book written by a white person for white people. The black person, I've read the book twice, and it was difficult to read because it's just so blatant. Just to piggyback on what Phil just said, to your question about people who complained about the way we protest, it's all about policing black bodies and the fact that some white people, consciously or unconsciously, feel that it is their right or feel that they have the privilege to determine how black people or how someone else handles the oppression, the marginalization that they are dealt with. And so White Fragility is a book for entry-level anti-racists. It's a book for people who at least understand that racism exists. I'm guessing it helps white people to start thinking about the process, but it's not for black people.
So the book came out, I guess, a couple of years ago, and it was a big seller then, but now amidst all of the civil unrest and the protests in this country and the thoughtful reflection that so many people are doing, it's back on the bestseller list a couple of years later. If this is a book by a white person for white people, I guess I want to ask you, as a Black person, Derek, what do you hope that people get from this then? I mean, it's not for you. It's for white people, and it's entry level. But what do you hope they get from it?
I hope people are able to consider and try to understand, try to empathize with experiences that may not be their own. As opposed to, you shouldn't be protesting like that. The question is, why are the people who killed Breonna Taylor not in jail, but protesters are? How would I feel if someone I knew were laying in bed, asleep, and killed? It's not about George Floyd being a Black man in Minnesota who was killed. It's about George Floyd being a human who should not have, who that whole experience should not have happened to. That, why is it that Black people are seven times more likely to be handled with force by the police, two times more likely to be killed? Hopefully people will think beyond the patriotism, beyond the indoctrination of what they've known or believed for forever, and consider experiences and ideas that may not be their own.
This book and its ideas are not without criticism. We're going to talk about some of that criticism and expand upon that in just a moment as we continue our conversation. And a little bit later, with more than 25 million older Americans living with economic insecurity, we explore why so many available funds for them go unclaimed. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our discussion on the perceived challenges of white people when talking about race. And we're joined by St. Peter's United Church of Christ, Reverend Derek Terry. Reverend, thank you for sticking around with us.
No problem.
We also have with us the Director of Learning and Culture for Leadership for Educational Equity, Kate McCracken. Kate, thanks for being here as well.
My pleasure.
And we have Miami University Assistant Professor Phil Smith, and it looks like we lost him, but we are going to try to reconnect with him and bring him back into the conversation as well. You can join this conversation at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and questions there as well. I want to read a review, a part of a review of White Fragility, the book by Robin DiAngelo that sparked this conversation. It's a review from John McWhorter of The Atlantic, and it reads, quote, "White Fragility is, in the end, a book about how to make certain educated white readers feel better about themselves. DiAngelo's outlook rests upon a depiction of Black people as endlessly delicate poster children within this self-gratifying fantasy about how white America needs to think or better stop thinking." He goes on to write, "Her answer to white fragility, in other words, entails an elaborate and pitilessly dehumanizing condescension toward Black people." He writes, "The sad truth is that anyone falling under the sway of this blinkered, self-satisfied, punitive stunt of a primer has been taught by a well-intentioned but tragically misguided pastor how to be racist in a whole new way." Carlos Lozada, writing for The Washington Post, wrote, "People of color rarely emerge as fully formed characters in these pages, except to provide opportunities for white Americans to engage in an authentic exploration of racial realities. That is to help them know when they are doing better." So, Kate McCracken, let's bring this over to you. You were presenting as part of the panel discussion about this book and the themes within as part of the program from St. Peter's United Church of Christ. What is your reaction to those types of reviews about the messages in White Fragility?
I'm so glad we're talking about this. I just read McWhorter's critique in The Atlantic just the other day.
And I both agree and still think that the book has value. One of the points that I tried to make in my portion of the panel is that to truly be anti-racist, what is being asked of us as white people is not necessarily to do things different, although that's part of it, but rather to be different. And one of the main ways I think we need to be different is to be able to hold disparate things, to be able to say yes and. So just a few minutes ago, Derek described the book as a primer, a starting place, an entry-level text, and I absolutely agree. It introduces some basic concepts to give folks insight into how they are experiencing the world about race that they may not have had any clue were even happening because they were just socialized to experience them as normal or typical or default. What the book misses is nuance. What the book misses is things like the book says, and McWhorter names this in his critique too, the book says, never ask a Black person or person of color to educate you. There are really no nevers in this work once you get past the entry level in the context of the right relationship with someone or with someone like Reverend Terry. He wants you to ask. He is offering himself and his service as an educator in this way. And so I think that's a weakness of the book. I don't feel like I can speak so much to McWhorter or the other author's perspective as men of color about how they're portrayed in the book, but I certainly trust their views and reading other people's response to the critiques. I trust other folks of color who are saying they don't experience in that way. And I think it's so important to name that reality in this work, that there is no single voice who speaks for everyone of any racial group or ideological view, and this really requires us to be flexible and fluid and open to learning and change in ways that, again, most white people are not taught.
And we have reconnected with Miami University Assistant Professor Phil Smith. Phil, sorry that we had a technical glitch there, but we're glad that you're back on. And I want to ask you, if we read from the book White Fragility, that we're not to lean on Black people to coach us through this process, to help us understand how to be better citizens for everyone in this country. How do you go about instigating a conversation with your white peers, your white family, your white friends, and to do that in a way where ideally you end up with some sort of successful outcome?
That's a great question. And I don't think, you know, just to reiterate what's already been said very quickly, I don't think we can get through this without relying on people who actually experience racism and oppression to talk to us about it. And there's many, many ways to do that. But building on the point that we really need to be talking to each other as white people, how do you approach those conversations? it's a tricky thing, and I don't know that there's a better answer than to just start trying and having more conversations and bringing it up when you can and when it makes sense to, which turns out to be a lot of time. I find myself having conversations about race and racism with my friends, with my family. There are things going on in the world now that more people are aware of that are great talking points. And so it's something you just kind of have to dive into and you're going to learn from the experience and kind of get better and think and reflect as you go about, oh, that didn't go so well, or what could I have done better in this situation? I just, you know, be yourself and bring your authentic self to conversations and just start going to it.
Reverend Derek Terry of St. Peter's United Church of Christ. Reverend, I want to go back to something we started to talk about at the beginning. This was something that you discussed in the panel discussion that your church hosted, and it's about how you can't get upset when someone gets it wrong, when we want them to get it right. So there's this wiggle room, there's this room for growth without being attacked, I suppose, is a way to interpret that. I want to talk about that in the context of what we title white privilege. Because I often see criticism of the term white privilege from white people who interpret that as to suggest that they were born with silver spoons in their mouth, that they didn't have to work hard to get what they got. And I'm wondering if you see the discussion of white privilege as somewhat flawed in its approach. That's not to suggest that it doesn't exist. We know that it does. But if you can't get through to the people that need to understand it, is there also possible exploration of a way that proponents get it wrong and need some time to get it right, a better way to approach that type of conversation?
Oh, man. So that's a big one. I think this builds upon the question that you just posed to Phil. It goes back to what do we do and how do we do this? The work that I do, the work that we do in Pleasant Ridge at St. Peter's, the baseline is you understand that racism exists and you understand that white people are treated better by the system in our society. Those are the two premises that most people agree on when they come to our stuff. I think it's really easy for people to go back to what Bill was saying earlier, to deflect with defense mechanisms when they hear certain terms. White privilege, because as soon as they hear privilege, oh, well, I was, you know, born poor, so that's not me. And so it's really easy for people to deflect and to push back. And so I try not to use phrases like white privilege for that reason. But at the same time, it's very frustrating when people look for those little things to push back on so that they can just shut down, so that they don't do the work or don't have the conversations. There's also a difference between having these individual, you know, sitting around conversations with your white friends, your white relatives about, you know, the issues of black people, and as opposed to what we're trying to do, which is actually break systems of oppression and marginalization. I understand the importance of having the personal conversations, but my ultimate goal is to not make so-and-so an anti-racist or to not make such-and-such no longer be racist. It really is to attack those systems. I think arguing with your uncle at Thanksgiving is counterproductive. I think getting prosecutors elected, getting judges on the bench, getting people who are anti-racist in positions of power where they can make change, I think that's the goal.
Kate McCracken is the Director of Learning and Culture for Leadership for Educational Equity. And Kate, you sort of touched on this in your presentation as part of this panel discussion, where you explore what we white people are taught to believe about ourselves. And one of those items is that everyone gets what they deserve. Everyone gets what they earn. And that's what prompted my question about white privilege in this context of white fragility, because as Derek said, there will be people who will say, I don't benefit from white privilege because I was poor or I am poor and had to claw my way out of that. Can you expand on that from the viewpoint of a white person?
Absolutely. Similarly to Derek, I often won't use the word anymore because it does tend to get people stuck in this place of insisting that they don't experience it. But when it comes up or when I find myself as a white person explaining to another white person what white privilege or the idea of privilege is all about, what I've found to be effective is the understanding that we're not talking about privilege in the general view or any person's previous understanding of the word privilege. It doesn't mean you've never had a hard time. It doesn't mean you haven't faced difficulty. It doesn't mean that the other aspects of your identity or experience, especially related to things like income level or poverty, weren't an influence in your life. The example that I use is it means you're less likely to be killed by a police officer. It means you're more likely to have your resume chosen for an interview if your name appears white or does not appear to belong to a person of color. And naming those things, it almost makes me wish we had another word, but we don't. So we just work with what we work with. Redefining all the vocabulary for this work isn't going to make it easier. Folks are going to still find ways to poke holes in the words. But making space for folks to see people who have had difficult moments and have empathy for them, and then focus on what's really effective, like Derek said. That's how I address the topic of white privilege and understand it myself.
In our last minute together, I want to turn it over to Miami University Assistant Professor Phil Smith, because we talked about this earlier in the segment, Phil. We talked about how some people feel that they can't be racist because they also have some other type of minority status or nationality status that they think bonds them to the Black experience in some capacity. It seems that the concept of white privilege could be better understood if that thought process were more fully formed, if you did look for those commonalities, if you looked for those shared experiences rather than for ways to distance yourself, is that something you can help us understand? Like, is there a way that might not be condescending or offensive to look for commonalities and to build upon those?
It's such a great point, Michael, in terms of thinking about oppression as oppression. And whether you're talking about, you're talking about racism in America versus racism in the UK, oppression is oppression. And so there is an importance on connecting and having that connection and understanding what sources of power are creating these commonalities and experiences of oppression. It's a really important humanizing thing to talk about and an aspect of connecting with each other about shared experiences. But it can't shut off the conversation about the differences and the uniqueness of this oppression in this context versus this context. And because that context might require different solutions, different anti-racist policies, dismantling systems in different ways. And of course, the commonalities are there too. But when it becomes problematic, again, is where somebody takes that commonality and then dismisses any conversation about a difference or the other individual's experience or differences in experiences, because differences within one group or another are going to be very different. But of course, there's common experiences there too. So it's fully recognizing the situation, for a lack of better term, by acknowledging the commonalities, but having the really important conversations about the differences as well.
Well, I'm grateful for the conversation that we had today, and thank you for taking the time to expand upon the panel discussion that was hosted earlier this summer. My thanks to Reverend Derek Taylor, Miami University Assistant Professor Phil Smith, and Director of Learning and Culture for Leadership for Educational Equity, Kate McCracken, for being with us today. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
I said Derek Taylor. I want to just correct myself. I meant Derek Terry.
It's all good.
So sorry, Reverend. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
All righty. Yes, sir. Take care.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.